Thank you, Virginie. Thank you all. So when Virginie invited me to speak to you about my research, I'm going to be talking to you about a project that is completed, because I'm just at the beginning of a new project, and therefore I don't have much to tell you about that one. But this is about the TICRAF EU project, which I think I can do it like this. Mm-hmm. Yeah, which I just put up there just to show you I'm presenting it, but it's really the product of a huge collaboration of many institutions across Europe, but also in sub-Saharan Africa. And it was actually financed by two funders. One is Norface, and the other one is the Dutch National Science Foundation, kind of like the CNRS, I think, in France. And I just mentioned this because it's going to, we might even have a discussion part of it later, but it's about doing team projects. It's very different from doing your own project. And I came to this after having already done one interdisciplinary large project. But of course, before then, my PhD was a joint project. But anyway, it's very different from working on your own. And there's lots of intricacies, but also lots of benefits, I think, on working this way. And especially for this topic that I'm going to present to you today on transnational families, it was very beneficial for us to be a big team of people working together. So what this project is about, it's called TICRAF EU and TICRA Ghana. They're two projects funded by two different organizations, but it's part of the same thing. Stands for Transnational Child Raising Arrangements Between Africa and Europe. And the main focus of our attention are transnational families. And what we mean by transnational families is such as this one that I exemplify here, where there's a Ghanaian migrant living in Amsterdam. This is the woman who you see on the screen. She's working in a braiding salon in Amsterdam Southeast. When she came to the Netherlands, she left her son, Kofi, back in Ghana, in one village in the Ashanti region of Ghana, which is the region that has a lot of migrants coming to Europe. And she left him in the care of her mother, who is there on the picture. So you see Kofi and the mother of Akuya, so his grandmother. And that's what we mean by a transnational family. So a family that is living across national borders, but where they're still feeling and acting and caring as a family. And the main questions that we were interested in investigating is, how can one do family? Because family is, you work at being a family, it's not automatic that you're a family. How can one do family across such large borders? And who are those meaningful actors that are involved? And how do they negotiate these different relationships through not only large distances, but also through large, administrative and bureaucratic hurdles that they might encounter because they are in these different countries? So our projects focused... Well, let me first start from a theoretical angle. The reason why we chose to do this kind of research and we're asking these kinds of questions is because there were actually an emerging body of literature, more or less from the 2000s onward, called Transnational Family Studies. And these studies largely come from the broader field of migration studies. They were largely conducted by especially anthropologists and qualitative sociologists. So they have a qualitative approach to studying these families. And what they find, their main findings tended to be that the people involved in transnational families, there are negative outcomes for them. So negative well-being effects, so especially related to the parents and especially mothers, feelings of depression or stress or feelings of guilt and abandonment because they, when they left, they hadn't expected the migration to be so long or not to be able to be with their children, and general dissatisfaction with life. What these findings found, they nuance these findings, and they find that there are, for example, differences between mothers and fathers. Although there, what's interesting is that when you look at these studies, they mainly talk to mothers, so the fathers are largely absent. They also emphasize the importance of the caregiver. So how people are feeling in these families is very important role of the caregiver, the person who is taking care of the child. Because this person, who could be a grandmother, for example, might be able to explain to the child, look, your mother has left because she loves you and because she wants to care for you. That's why she's gone. So then the child will feel very differently about his mother's migration than, say, if it's an auntie who is maybe jealous of the mother who migrated and who starts saying, yeah, your mother's overseas and she sends us nothing. Then the child will feel differently. So this central role of the caregiver. Then they also mentioned that the quality of the relationships between these three people is extremely important. And finally, that there are some very strong expectations of reunification with these family within these families, whether this reunification is at the origin or at the destination, and that information and communication technologies are extremely important in being able to facilitate these relationships. So I mentioned here some of the studies that were really fundamental in shaping this area of transnational family studies. But because these are largely small-scale studies, there was no comparison group, and that is, they focus only on transnational families. So all of these findings, we're not 100% sure, are these findings because these families are transnational, or are these findings maybe because these families are being affected by other things that might be affecting a larger group of families? So that was first the first gap that we identified. Secondly, as I mentioned, the main source of information of these studies were mothers, were parents, and usually mothers. So there was an absence of the male voice, but actually there was an absence also of children's voices. And finally, these studies that I mentioned above are from Latin America and Southeast Asia for the most part. So there's also a lack of understanding of the families stemming from Africa, and we felt that possibly the African or certain African normative contexts of what it means to be family might be so different than other contexts that you find in Latin America and Southeast Asia that it would be worth looking at these cases of Africa to see if the normative context might also be influential. So what we did, based on this general knowledge of the literature and our interest in trying to find out something more about these families, is we did some very preliminary field work in different African countries, but especially Ghana, to interview children who had parents overseas and to try and understand how do they view these things. And I just have a couple of quotes here just to show you the sort of range of possible reactions that we got from children. And one is from Emmanuel, who was 17 years old at the time that we interviewed him. And he says, when he was here, his father, he wouldn't buy these things, but he would have said that it was a waste. But when he went there, and he's talking about where his father is, and when I told him, Dad, I want this, then he would send it. So we asked, so everything you ask for, he sends? Yes, and that makes me happy. Right? So this is sort of what some authors have called the commodification of care, but it's also something that's very present in children, that they feel that they are able to have more things when they have a migrant father. But we also encountered other types of feelings, like this one, which really shows resentment. So Puma, an 18-year-old, said, I think one day I was in school when he called me, and I asked, who is this? And he told me, it's your dad. Then I asked him, what do you want from me? He was annoyed that I asked him what he wanted from me. And I said, yes, you have not been catering for me since I was born, from junior high school to now senior high school. So what do you want from me that you're calling me? So I just cut the line. You know, this is really very strong, a lot of resentment. You know, you never call me, you never show you love me in any way. Now you call me, what do you want from me? And he hangs up. So this is really a lot of strong emotional feelings against the father. And then finally, this one, Jacqueline, who was 12 years old, who instead shows understanding of the situation of her mother. So she says, She said she was going to work so that she can take care of us. That's why she had to leave. And I say, okay, if she's going to work, she can go. Because when she was in Ghana, she had nothing to do. She was just sewing some people's clothes, and they paid little for that. That's why she was going, to take care of us. So this really shows, you know, understanding why the mother is leaving. These were just one-off semi-structured interviews, so we don't know what's behind this, but it could be that there's a caregiver that is explaining to Jacqueline also, you know, your mother is doing this so she can take care of you. And finally, and this is, I think, really important to keep in mind for later what I'm going to show you in the presentation, but there is Gottlieb, who's 13 years old, and he said, the stepmother I'm living with, she treats me like a real son. So now I live very comfortably. I take her as my own mother. So I don't feel like if this guy's having his or her mother around, I don't miss her, talking about his biological mother. I know I have a mother who loves me. But then he goes on and he says, I'm more close to my mom, the one in the UK, because she's my mother. But my stepmother, she's now my mother. She's taken like the position of my mother in my heart now. But still, my mom is the one I really love, really. And what I love about this quote is it just shows this, you know, on the one hand, ambivalence, but on the other hand, this possibility of having two moms and also of having space for two moms in your heart, and which I think is going to be very important also for understanding a little bit later on some of these African contexts that we've been researching. So because of this whole array of feelings, and because there's no clear story that's coming out, and certainly no clear story of suffering and a lack of well-being. I mean, some are, some aren't. We decided, let's do this larger study, also a quantitative study, to try and understand a little bit more about how parental migration is impacting the well-being of children who stay back in African countries. And so to do this, we started from transnational family studies, but then we turned to the body of literature coming from child development and family sociology studies. And these tend to be large quantitative studies, but they mainly focus on families living together, these large-scale quantitative. So they're not necessarily focusing on migration or migrants or... But even when they're thinking about families that are not living together, they're thinking of situations like divorce or like some kind of tragedy in the family, or maybe a mother who is a drug addict and gets put institutionalized. So there's very little that was actually focusing on migration in terms of reasons for family separation. Thirdly, they're very based on clinical data, so on people who actually come for some kind of help. So you get already a very biased sample there. They're mainly based on weird societies. I don't know if you know what weird is, but weird is, let's see, Western, educated, industrial, rich, and developed societies. And actually, you can even say, so us, basically, right? France, Netherlands, Europe, North America. And you can actually even say that of these weird societies, they're basically based on U.S. college students. Most of these studies are based on U.S. college students. So we know a lot about the child psychological development of U.S. college students, but we don't know much about other societies. But and then only recently, you can see from the dates of these publications that I've mentioned, there was recent attention of these larger scale studies on transnational families. And these are studies that come from China, because there's a lot of rural to urban migration. So technically, they're not transnational families, but because of the hukou system that they have in China, it's also huge administrative hurdles. And they face many of the same challenges as families that migrate internationally. And also studies from Mexico and Southeast Asia. And the gaps that we identified was that not all of the issues that were dealt with in the qualitative transnational family literature were actually taken up by these more large-scale quantitative studies. They didn't look at certain of the issues. So there was a whole range of issues that hadn't been investigated on a large scale. Hardly any of these studies were comparative. They only focus on one, for example, one country, Mexico. Again, the focus was on Latin America and Asia, and again, they're primarily based on adult assessments. So we started our research. This is now giving you an idea of what literatures we come from and why we were doing this research. What we did was we selected three African countries and three European countries based on large flows of migrants from a particular African country to a particular European country. So we have Angola, and we interviewed parents in Portugal, because there's a huge Angola-Portugal flow. We interviewed children in Angola, but we also added, we always have the Netherlands as a sort of contrast comparative case. So we also interviewed Angolan parents in the Netherlands. Then we had Nigeria, and this might come as a surprise, but there are many Nigerians in Ireland. So we have, actually because of the laws, we can get into that later, but so we have Nigerian children, Nigerian parents in Ireland, and then the contrast case, which is Nigerian parents in the Netherlands. And then finally we have Ghanaians in the Netherlands, which again represents, the Ghanaians are the largest group from sub-Saharan Africa in the Netherlands. So we have all of these flows. There are five in total, if you were right. And what we did, we used mixed methods. So we did surveys in schools in Africa. We did ethnographic interviews and life history interviews and a lot of observation in these families, both in Africa with the children and the caregivers, and in Europe with the parents. And then we did institutional studies on specifically migration laws and family norms and school systems in these different countries to try and understand how these institutional contexts might shape the way that families operate. And then we also did parent surveys in Europe. What I'm going to present to you today mainly focuses on the children. So it's going to be a lot of from the school surveys. Bear with me, it's a little bit quantitative, but it's, I hope, going to be interesting anyway. And then, of course, we used a lot of our insights from the qualitative ethnographic work in order to understand these quantitative findings. Our qualitative work ended up being much less on the children than we had hoped, because doing qualitative work with young people is very challenging, requires a whole set of very particular methodologies, and in a way, this was maybe a little bit too ambitious to try and do this with all of these people, parents, caregivers, and children. But I will go into our findings also from the qualitative side to show you how our more broader findings can be explained. So we started off with doing school surveys in these three African countries, choosing largely the big cities, urban contexts, and urban contexts where there's a lot of out-migration. For each country, we had approximately 2,250 pupils that we surveyed. These were kids ranging between the years of 11 and 21, which is basically just determined by the fact that we were going to junior high schools and senior high schools, and that's just the age range of kids. We did have one pupil who was 48 years old, but we decided not to include her in the survey. These schools were randomly selected and stratified by high, low quality and junior and senior high schools. And as I said, we interviewed in areas of high out-migration. Just to give you a little bit of context of these three African countries, first of all, one thing that is very important to highlight is that in all of these three countries, the norm of child fostering and social parenthood is quite common, meaning that it is irrespective of migration. So even if you don't have migrant parents, it is quite common that you will, for example, if you're a woman, you can give your child to your sister or to your mother to be raised. And then that child is for that person. So that's the kind of child fostering arrangements that are present and still prevalent in these countries. But what makes Angola quite different is, of course, the disruption of family life because of the war in Angola, which lasted so long that really had an impact on families, and there have been studies that have shown that families are quite scattered, and sometimes people still don't know where some of their family members are. So there's this context of sort of scattered, splintered families in Angola. Now, migration to Europe, in Ghana and Nigeria, it's quite similar. That started in large numbers in the 1980s, mainly people coming to Europe as labor migrants. In Angola, there has been this historical migration to Portugal, but especially due to the conflict and the war in Angola, a lot of the more recent migrants are actually refugees entering Europe under as asylum seekers and then being granted refugee status. Also in terms of gender, all three flows are very equal in terms of men and women. And, well, I put in terms of the political and economic context, just, I mean, I highlighted the Human Development Index, and you can see that at least at the time of study, because, of course, many things are changing rapidly, and then Angola is becoming quickly a richer and richer country. But in terms of the Human Development Index, Ghana at the time was the country that was doing the best, and Nigeria the worst. Okay. So now I turn to the survey, and what this here shows is just an indication of the different types of families that we actually found. So what you see here is the yellow, that's the largest group in all the three countries, are families where it's the father who migrated and the children are living with their mother. So the caregiver, that person who is located, is the mother. But then you also have these orange families that are just almost as equally important in all three countries, which is where both parents have migrated, and the child is actually living with someone else, so living with a carer. The bottom group, which is less important but still, you know, representing 10% of the cases, are families where the mother actually migrated and the child is living with the father. So these are just to give you an impression that not all transnational families are the same form. Sometimes you're living with the other parent, sometimes the other parent is the mother, sometimes the father, sometimes instead both parents have migrated and you're living with someone else. So what we did was we used this psychological well-being indicator that has actually been used and tested and developed in different cultural contexts. It's been used, for example, in Vietnam. We first tested it in the Ghanaian case, and we worked with child development psychologists in Ghana to see whether this indicator made sense in the Ghanaian context. And we found that it was actually quite working quite well. And this total difficulties score that we can compute from the strengths and difficulties questionnaire comes up with an indicator of a child's, what we call the child psychological well-being. This is an index that's composed of 20 questions, questions like, I am nice to other people. And then the child had three options saying, agree, most always agree, mostly agree, or disagree. Okay? I fight a lot. I am often unhappy. These are very easy questions because then you can ask children directly to fill it in. They don't need someone else, an adult, to answer it for them. So what we found is here that these are the three countries, Ghana, Angola, and Nigeria, that the pink bar are children who are living in a transnational family. So it means that there are children who have at least one parent who has migrated. And what you find is that the pink bar, so the children in transnational families, have worse psychological well-being, because the higher your psychological the well-being indicator is, the worse is your well-being. So we see that generally the pink bar is higher than the blue bar, which is when children instead are living with their families. So that's already something that says, hey, these qualitative studies that we're saying that there's something, you know, wrong with these kids, or something, it's worse for kids to be in transnational families, this seems to give support to that. But there's two other things that you can see here. First of all, that in both Ghana and Nigeria, this difference is not very big. But in Angola, it's quite big. Okay, but now you might say, well, but you're putting in the pink bar, you're putting all kids who have migrant parents. But maybe it's also the poorest kids. So maybe the bad psychological well-being is also a factor of them being poor rather than of them having a migrant family, right? So this is just lumping everybody together. So then we went to do some further analyses where we also try to control for these other factors like poverty, level of income, etc. Yeah, you had a question. Oui.
L'envolade, est-ce que ça veut dire que tous les contextes sont surdéterminants?
La guerre.
Oui, c'est la guerre, par exemple. Oui.
Voilà. So that's c'est ça la question. C'est qu'est-ce qui détermine ces différences. Donc c'est la prochaine slide. Alors je reviens à l'anglais. So it's the next slide is exactly that we were saying. What determines these differences? One, it can be the context, like Angola, more conflict. But two, it can also be just the characteristics of these kids. Maybe it's the parents of very poor children who tend to migrate. And then what we're measuring is not so much the effect of migration, but we're measuring maybe the effect of being poor. So we need to disaggregate this. We need to understand this a bit more. So in order to do that, what we did was we did some things that to control. So one thing we controlled for the age and the gender and the ethnicity of the child. We also looked at certain family characteristics of the child. And then we looked at the living conditions. So these are things that we tried to get at more their financial well-being, their economic well-being. So we controlled for these things in the quantitative analysis. And importantly, because that's how we wanted to bring in the insights from the qualitative studies, we also wanted to analyze, well, but what kind of transnational family do they live in? Because maybe it's not just being in a transnational family that's worse, but maybe it's when you're in a particular type of transnational family. And it's important to try and find out, because if you're thinking of, you know, policy advice or any intervention, this might be a give us some clues as to how we might intervene. So we looked at, well, which parent migrates? Does that make a difference? Is it, for example, that children whose mothers migrate are doing better than children whose fathers migrate? And that's a question that we ask because the transnational family studies were saying it makes a difference if it's a mother or a father. Then we also looked at the stability of the child raising arrangement. What I mean by that is, if I leave on migration and I leave my child with you, will my child always stay with you while I'm on migration? Or after maybe 2 years, you get tired and you give my child to her and then she gets tired or she, you know, something happens and gives my child. That's an unstable caregiving arrangement. And we were interested in that because the child psychology literature that doesn't look at migrant families but looks at other kinds of families, like divorced families, says that that's a very important factor. But surprisingly, no one had ever looked at this for transnational families. Why? Because we as academics, we're so focused on our bodies of literature or disciplines where we come from that we don't think of mixing the two. And so we said, well, let's treat migration as just one other form of family separation, and let's see what scholars about family separation say, and let's look at whether that is also pertinent for migrant families. Then the third one is we were interested in also looking at who is the caregiver. Does that make a difference? That's, again, transnational family studies said that the caregiver is important, so we need to look at that. And finally, does it matter where the parents migrate to? So if parents go to migrate internationally to Africa, does that make a difference? Or if parents migrate nationally, or if parents migrate to Europe, are there differences in this? So that's what we looked at. And this is our way of analysis. So we used these kinds of regression analyses, and we ran separate models for each of the transnational family dimensions. But I think this is less important, but if you want, we can go back to this in the question answer period. And now I will tell you my findings. I start with telling you our findings. So first of all, we find that living in a transnational family does not necessarily lead to worse outcomes. That is, we find that there are certain transnational family formations that actually children do not show any difference from children who are living with both of their parents. And for us, this is a really important finding because until now, it was always said that actually children are always worse off. But they're not, is what we're finding. Secondly, it really depends on the particular characteristics of the child-raising arrangement. and I'm going to go into these characteristics. Which are the characteristics that matter? Those, that's important to know. But not only the child raising the family level characteristics, but also that the sending country, the origin country context matters. And you already, mentioned about the difference in Angola, and we'll go into this a little bit later. But obviously, the sending country also matters. And I emphasize this because most of our research on migrants and on migrant families is always looking at the destination country. We're always doing research about migrant parents here. And we have much less research looking at what the situation is from the sending country context. So now I'm going to go into the findings, and I'm going to go to the first one about the transnational family characteristic. And this is just a graphical representation of all of these large tables with numbers and statistical significance and this and that. And I think this is just a way to highlight for you what is most important. The way to read this is very simple. If the bar is filled in, it means it is a significant difference. If the bar is not filled in, it means there's no significant difference from the children who live together. Okay. When it's significant, I've also put stars that shows you how significant it is. More stars, more significance. So, what you see here, for example, is that in Nigeria and in Angola, when mothers move and the children are living with fathers, their psychological distress or their psychological well-being is worse, and it's significantly worse than children who are living with both parents. Okay. I hate this result. Can you imagine why?
Because it confirms the literature, no?
Well, but if the literature went, yes. But it confirms the literature that has, until now, said that when mothers migrate, it's bad. Guilty. And you have then politicians who then, or policymakers who then translate this into saying we need to restrict women's mobility, such as has been done by law in Sri Lanka. Maybe you know. But by law in Sri Lanka, a woman cannot migrate unless she has the permission of her husband. Sri Lanka is also a country that has, the report by UNICEF says 1 million children are living without their moms because their moms have migrated. Okay. But, and here is important, this category that we have is the mother has migrated, but the child is living with the father. So we're saying maybe it's just that the father is a bad caregiver. Maybe it's not that the mother is bad because she migrates. It might be that the father just isn't able to provide that caring environment. So now we're currently working on a paper to try and dig deeper into this and asking why is this, what's behind it? And one thing that's behind it, I can show you later, is that it seems that women have fewer network members that they can ask to take care of their children. Which is surprising because we always think, oh, Africa, extended family, takes a village to raise a child, so you always have, you know, someone who will take care. But actually, no, it's not that easy. Okay, but what I wanted also to emphasize is the non-significant findings, which is saying basically, for example, let's take the top bar in Nigeria and in Ghana, the green one. When both parents are away, there's no significant difference in the well-being of children relative to those children who are living with both of their parents. And the same thing for the last bar, when the father is away and they're living with their mother. And in Ghana, even when the mother's away, it doesn't make a difference. So basically, there are certain contexts where these children seem to be faring quite well, even when their parents migrate. So that's important to highlight, because it is adding, I would say, some nuance to a predominantly negative literature. This is the most, I think, the most, one of the most clear findings, and that's the stability of the caregiver. So the top bar in each three are when the child has changed his carer twice or more. So I leave my child with you, that's one caregiver. Then you give my child to her, that's two caregivers. When this has happened two times or more is the top bar. And indeed, you can see that in all three cases, the top bar is significant and worse. In all three cases. So basically what this is showing is that migrant families are no different than like divorced families, or and the child just needs some kind of stability. It doesn't have to be the biological parent, but it should be some kind of stability. And again, this is important because it gives also some kind of insight into why maybe women, you know, families where women are migrating, children are worse off. It's not so much maybe the special bond that mother and child have, which is something that like someone like Pareñas has argued for Filipino children. But maybe it's that these fathers aren't very much giving them a stable because it's the father who's caring, but maybe it's not really the father. Maybe it's an auntie, and then the auntie doesn't feel like she's really responsible, so maybe it's someone else. So these children are not. So this is giving us some more understanding into what's going on in these families. And I also, like before, want to emphasize the non-significant ones, which is so when the child never changed the caregiver, and you might say, what do you mean never changed? I have to make a correction to what I just said. Never changed means before I leave, I give you my daughter. Mm-hmm. And my daughter stays with you the whole time.
Oh, okay.
Then never change. Okay. Change to her is a one change. Change to her is a second change. Yeah, so... So when I leave my and I give my child to someone, and that child stays always with the same person, there's absolutely no difference in the Ghanaian and in the Nigerian case. I'm going to come back to the Angolan case because, as you can see, it's clearly very different. Okay, who is the caregiver? Well, here I want to highlight, first of all, that in Nigeria and in Ghana, who the caregiver is hardly seems to matter. So whether the caregiver is the mother or the father or the grandparent, the aunt or uncle, or one of the parents or some other person. Sometimes we had a pastor, sometimes we had a friend. Doesn't seem to make a difference. But here, what you can see, these two lines I highlight because this was instead surprising for us. When the carer is the other parent, at least in Angola and in Nigeria, that seems to make a difference in terms of being worse off than children who are living with both. And that to us didn't make sense. Because you would expect that a child who is living at least with his dad would be better off than a child who's living with no biological parent, mm-hmm. or vice versa, with his mom better off. So this to us was confusing result, and we didn't know why. And that's where we turned to the qualitative ethnographers who were also doing research with a select number of families. And what they were telling us is actually when a migrant migrates and is not able to send back remittances, there are all sorts of tensions that develop in the couple when it's one of the couple. Why is he not sending me back remittances? What is he doing overseas? Has he taken on another family? Does he have another wife? Is he courting a girlfriend or vice versa? Why is she not being a good, you know, the good wife? And then, so it creates tensions in the family. And with some of these, and I would say a majority of these migrants that we were interviewing, this was often the case, that especially in the beginning parts of the migration process, people aren't able to remit, send money back in the way they were expecting to, because it takes a long time to find a job, to, if you don't have papers, to enter the black market, and the costs are always much higher than, you know, renting, etc. So before you can actually remit, it takes quite a lot of time, and this seems to create. So maybe what we're picking up here, and this is a hypothesis, it's not proven, but maybe what we're picking up here is that if there's tension in the couple, then the child also feels it. And that's why it's worse if the other caregiver is the other parent. Okay. And I just mentioned this, that it doesn't really make much of a difference. So just to reiterate my conclusions, at least at the micro level, at the family level, is that transnational family is not always associated with being worse off in terms of your psychological well-being for children. It's important to look at the different transnational family dimensions And if you have a stable caregiving arrangement, it's actually good for the child. Who the non-parental caregiver is doesn't matter. But if one parent migrates and the other stays behind, this seems to be a situation where children can suffer. And when mothers migrates and father stays with the child, this also seems to be a situation when the child might not be doing as well. And one result that I didn't show you here on the screen, but was where the migrant migrates to. Does the migrant just stay in Ghana, for example, or in Nigeria, migrates to a big city in Nigeria versus migrating to Europe? That doesn't seem to matter in terms of child well-being. So that's the first at the micro level. But then, of course, we also controlled for different types of context, and we controlled for the economic conditions of the child, and we found that that was very significant. So if a child was living in good conditions, that was actually something that helped the well-being of the child, and irrespective of the transnational family that he was living in. So it's also important to emphasize this, because if you're a policymaker in one of these African countries, then you know that you need to be catering. Maybe it's not a migration issue. Maybe it's a poverty issue or a well-being issue, I mean, economic well-being. And secondly, we found that children in Ghana attending better quality schools had actually better emotional outcomes. Here too, this is an important contextual factor at the meso level, and also for policymakers saying, hey, it's really good to provide these kids with good, high-quality school environments. So these are meso-level findings. And then finally, at the macro level, what I just did was I put here the three graphs that we saw. I actually even added the national, international one. And I just wanted to highlight, you know, how in all cases, no matter what kind of transnational family we looked at, Angola was always significantly worse. Children were significantly worse off than the children who were living with both parents. And they were also a lot worse than in Nigeria and in Ghana. Mm-hmm. And here, of course, we turn to the, you know, you mentioned because of the conflict. And when we look at the child development literature that takes place in conflict and post-conflict settings, not looking at migration, but just at the general well-being of children, they find that children in these contexts are much more vulnerable to shocks to their system. So if something happens that changes their system, it's a shock, then they react to the shock in a much greater way than children who are not in conflict or post-conflict settings. So what we, again, hypothesizing, because we can't prove it, but what we think we're picking up is that migration of a parent for a child who has lived in a context of conflict is a shock to his or her system, and this child will react all that much more than a child who's not in such a context. And this really corroborates this kinds of findings. So we're using these literatures from child development, psychology in conflict settings to understand these kinds of findings. And I think, you know, yeah, you could argue, yeah, but it could be something else. True, it could be something else, and therefore we would need to maybe do some more studies like this in other conflict and post-conflict settings. But still, I think the evidence here is just so strong, you know, how different Angola is from the other countries. And there aren't other things that make them so different. So Angola, it's also men and women who migrate. Angola is also it's also a context where child fostering and social parenthood norms exist. You know, there could be something about, well, but most Angolans are migrating to Portugal, and maybe Portugal is a context that makes parents less able to work in transnational families, so maybe it's the context of the destination country. True, but my feeling is that, you know, this conflict setting really has a big impact in terms of how children are faring back home. So, so I think what I want to sort of in conclusion, just to understand these macro level factors, you know, why is it that we're finding that certain conditions don't seem to make children so much worse off? Why is that? And I think that what can help us explain partially is that these norms of child fostering and social parenthood make it so that children who are not living with their biological parents because their parents have migrated, they don't necessarily feel so different or so less privileged or less well off than a child who is going to school with them and sitting next to them, who maybe also isn't being taken care of by their biological parent, but not because the parent migrated, but just because they're part of this child fostering system. So that's something that, again, Pareñas in the Philippines has really emphasized, how children whose parents have migrated really feel like they're lacking something. They feel like, so there's this kind of stigmatization almost of being a child. And I think actually it would be interesting to compare with your notes,
Severin,
on Mexico, because that's also something that in Mexico, at least from my understanding, there's such a strong also Catholic normative context which says that the nuclear family is the ideal. Right? Mother, father, loving mother, loving father, and loving child. And this is beautiful. So, of course, if you're a child not in that context, you feel like something's missing. Well, as you saw in the quotes that I started off with at the very beginning, not all children feel like they're missing something. And Gottlieb at the end, who was saying, I have a place for both of my moms in my heart, is actually something that you can find in this context. So I think that the social norms of social parenthood and child fostering can really be important in explaining why, in the African cases, we don't necessarily find these worse well-being effects for all children. And then, so this is what I've just explained. And I just have here some figures from the demographic and health surveys in these different countries. And what you see is, for example, children living with one parent while the other is away nationally or internationally. So in Ghana, you have almost a quarter of the children, this is a nationally representative survey, who are living with a parent who's away. We don't know why the parent is away. We don't know who the child is living with, but at least this gives us something about the context. And even in Nigeria, where the number is lower, it's still 14%. And these are kids below the age of 18, minors. Second one is children in foster care living with neither parent while one or both parents are alive. So that means these are not orphans. At least one parent, one of their parents is alive. And here again, you see, you know, these are kids who, it's quite large numbers. So it's just to highlight that the context in which these kids are living in is one that is very different from our Western normative context of, and I think that that can be a very clear reason why we might not be finding worse well-being outcomes. So children do not feel stigmatized, they do not feel like they have something less. And then, as I mentioned, the other macro context is the conflict setting. So we really need to be paying careful attention. And I think, you know, I presented this, for example, to some lawyers, migration lawyers, who were particularly busy with family reunification cases. And they said, this is really, you know, an interesting finding for us, because it's actually telling us that we need to pay particular attention to families in the cases of asylum seekers and refugees. And even though we have this impression that we're facilitating family reunification in the case of refugees, the actual legal conditions are extremely difficult. So it continues to be the case that parents and children takes a really long time for them to reunify. So they were very interested in our findings, just to be able to make a stronger case of why it is particularly important in the cases of refugees to have family reunification. Right, so this is just reiterating my final conclusions. Transnational family is not always associated with negative psychological well-being for children. It's important to look at the different dimensions of transnational families, a stability of the caregiver or gender of the migrant parent, for example. Cross-country comparisons, I think, are very important, because the particular sending country contexts result in different well-being effects in transnational families, So for us, having Angola as a case and being able to see it in comparison to these other two cases was very telling, because it was really showing, you know, you really can't come up with just generalizable conclusions about transnational families, which kind of tends to happen when you have the, you know, from the transnational family literature that was tending to really focus on these mothers who were feeling very bad about being separated from their children. And then you sort of see that there's then this whole discourse that emerges about how it's bad to be in a transnational family. But it really depends, is basically what we are saying. So that's where I'm ending. I just have here the papers that I draw on most for this presentation. So here you can see there's some of the collaborators who from the different countries who were co-authoring some of these articles. So that's it. Thank you.
Thank you.